This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon in his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 14, The Israelite Settlement in the Book of Judges.
We turn now to the Book of Judges, again, that comes after the Book of Joshua. And we see here on the PowerPoint slide one of my favorite paintings of which really captures, encapsulates ancient Israel. And you see here a community of Israelites tending to the grape harvest in the vineyard. You've got the watchtower here where they would be careful to watch over the crops, especially during harvest, their village. And then, of course, the terraced farming that you see here. And then in the valley, grain. So, and it's really a very nice pastoral scene of farmers and what the terrain and topography look like. This is, again, we'll unpack this in a little bit. That's an Israelite four-room house, typical dwelling. So this would have been possibly during the 8th century BC, maybe in Israel, maybe in Judah, during a time of peace and prosperity when they could have unwalled villages and enjoy focusing on harvest, not protecting themselves or having worries about foreign invaders. Now, when you talk about the Israelite settlement, this is a period, again, the period of the Judges. There are several important works. These are recent and not so recent works on the period of the Judges. Avi Faust, kind of an anthropological approach to Israel during the time of the Judges, excellent book. William G. Deaver wrote a book, Who Are the Early Israelites? Where Did They Come From? He again follows that indigenous origins model. Israel Finkelstein was published way back in 1988 when he was still writing good material. And he, at this time, argued more for a peaceful immigration. Now he's, I believe, indigenous like the rest. And finally, Lawrence Steger, who wrote an excellent chapter on the Israelite settlement, Forging an Identity, I believe is the name of the chapter in the biblical world. Excellent treatment there by Steger, and an excellent book to purchase. Now, when we talked about Egypt and we talked about Pharaoh Merneptah and the importance place this relatively minor pharaoh plays in biblical history, because he had an expedition, or you could say a raid, up into Canaan, and thankfully felt the need to boast about this raid and make this monument, the stela, where he mentions for the first time the nation, or the people, I should say, of Israel. And more than that, on the Karnak Temple portal, one of the walls of Karnak Temple, he actually depicts all of his stela in a series of reliefs. And Frank Yurko again believes that these, or and Anson Rainey believes that these figures here depicted are actually ancient Israelites. And again, the text of the Merneptah stela, roughly 1205 BC, so you're right at the beginning of the period of the Judges, when the Israelite tribes are settling down, building villages and houses and communities. The Pharaoh goes up there and kind of checks off all of these cities that he has plundered and destroyed and ravished. And then he comes to Israel, which is, again, the determinative there is a people, not a nation or a territory, but a people. Israel is desolated, her seed is not. And again, hyperbole here, not the fact that he ruined a crop or cut off their ability to procreate. He simply was using hyperbole here. Probably just ran over a few Israelite farmers with his chariots, etc. But he boasted that in this stela. What's kind of just kind of a almost a footnote now becomes extremely important, because Israel has to, even the most critical scholars have to identify that Israel existed as a people in Canaan in 1205 BC. Now, they still say that this, they call it proto-Israel and use all sorts of gymnastics to try to minimize this, but nothing can be done. They have to accept the fact logically that Israel existed as a people. So it's very important. And again, we talked about the fact that Merneptah may have actually had garrisons in the Holy Land and perhaps even in Jerusalem due to this place name in Joshua. May Nephtoah, the waters of Nephtoah, perhaps meant Merneptah. Okay, the spring of Merneptah. And again, this might have been changed during the creation of this document in Joshua, but Merneptah may be part of that text. The waters of Liphtah, west of Jerusalem. Now, we talked about pottery earlier, but pottery, again, has some ethnic identifiers. And this is, again, more important later in biblical history during the Iron Age. But even in this early period, for years, the collar rim jar. And why is it called a collar rim jar? Well, it kind of looks like a clerical collar here up on the top near the rim. And that was named by Albright from the pottery he excavated, I believe, at Tel Beit Mirsim. But these were identified as distinctly Israelite forms that the Israelites brought into Canaan. Well, further research over the decades since Albright used that name have determined that a lot of these are found at Israelite sites, but not exclusively. That there are Canaanite sites and other non-Israelite sites that used collar rim jars. There's variations of these. There's the tall rim, that is the northern form that was found at Dan. And we just had a student here at Andrews that did her PhD dissertation on this exact form, which we find a lot of in Jordan. So again, a possible ethnic identifier, but not you can't use this exclusively to identify a site as Israelite when you find these. But they were used extensively by the Israelites. And again, to point out the fact that Israelite pottery was distinctive in some ways from the Canaanite pottery, but it was very, very basic. Thick, heavy, clunky, not painted, not designed with any designs, not embellished in any way. It served a purpose, and it was practical, and that was it. So as time goes on, and we'll see during the reign of Solomon and beyond, pottery, Israelite pottery, becomes very beautiful and artistic and lovely. Here it's not so much. It's nice pottery, but very basic, kind of a plain brown wrapper or a very, very simple, but it does its job. These are various forms of cooking pots from that period in the Israelite settlement. Okay, we saw in that painting of the Israelite grape harvest, we saw a picture or a depiction of a four-room house. This is another artist rendition of a four-room house, typical Israelite housing form, and we have these at our sites in Jordan, in our Iron One sites in Jordan. What a four-room house is basically a rectangular structure with an entrance at the front, and it has a broad room in the back. And that broad room can have dividers, making it multiple rooms, but it has one door here, and it's either one or more rooms here. That's considered one room. Then it has three rooms, one, two, three, facing towards the entrance. And these rooms can be walled separately or can just simply have pillars to demarcate their size. And so that's called an Israelite four-room house. Now again, most Israelite Iron 1 and Iron 2 sites have this style of house. And there's several reasons for that. Usually this is an area for cooking or for animal care. Animals would be brought into the house for safety at night. And this back here might be for storage. The roof in the winter, or maybe a two-story house like here would be used for living quarters or sleeping, certainly at night in the summer where it's hot. And you don't want to sleep with the animals because of the animal odor and whatnot. So this is, served a function that way. It also served a defensive function because your back room could serve as a casemate. And in many cases did serve as a casemate because these would be attached together to other houses and actually make a perimeter wall, casemate wall, around a settlement, town, or farmstead. So again, a lot of variations. You can see on this one has some cisterns or pits here that was excavated, that were excavated, but a lot of different variations. But basically, a four-room house is one broad room in the back and three parallel rooms in the front. It's a large four-room house that's been partially restored at the site of Isbet Sarda. This is biblical Ebenezer. And I visited the site, and unfortunately it does not look like that now. It's in bad shape. Hopefully they've repaired it. But here you've got a side entrance. You can see pillars here. So one room, two rooms, three rooms. This has got partially has a wall. And then your broad room in the back. It's a very large house here, probably for the village chief or mukhtar, whatever you want to call the elites that lived in Ebenezer at the time of the Israelite settlement. Ebenezer or Isbet Sarda is a wonderful place to visit. It's all built up around there now. But you stand at the site of Isbet Sarda and look to the west, and you see the well-watered coastal plain right around the source of the Arkon River, Ras Ha'Ain. And that's where the Philistines were. And around the area around Isbet Sarda is hilly and rugged and rocky. And you think of those Israelites trying to eke out a living in this very difficult, rocky terrain, mountainous terrain, and they can look down just a mile away, just have beautifully well-watered farmland that the Philistines controlled. And you can understand the idea of the haves and the have-nots that they must have formulated in their minds, wishing, I wish I had land like that to farm instead of the difficult situation I'm in. Okay, we talked about the back broad rooms of houses serving as a casemate wall. Here's an outer wall of an Israelite settlement here, which is a casemate, and houses, again, would be connected to this. And this is, again, a reconstruction. I believe this is either Beersheba, the early strata of Beersheba, or perhaps Arad. We mentioned terracing when we looked at the slides of the Central Hill Country. Here's another, some other examples of terracing. Again, some of these still in use. These are still in use here, probably by Palestinian farmers. Others have fell into disrepair over the centuries. But the idea, again, is water, rainfall falling on this hillside and percolating down through the terraces and watering all of these olive trees or vines or whatever you're growing. And that was terrace farming was another somewhat of an Israelite innovation, though they had it earlier. Another thing the Israelites brought with them was lined pits, stone-lined and plastered pits or cisterns where they could hold water or grain underground that was safe from rodents or damage. And they had a special recipe of olive pits and plaster to make a plaster. Lime plaster that was impervious to water, and they could store items underground. And this is, again, I believe, from Isbet Sarda, some of the pits near that large four-room house. My favorite topic, what did Israelites eat? And you can see some modern Arab food here on this table. Israelites ate lots of vegetables and fruit that was in season. Bread was served probably at every meal, and most of the daytime work of the women of the house, the task of the women was grinding grain. And that sometimes took several hours just to make enough grain to make the bread for that day for the family. So maybe fruit and a little bit of bread in the morning, light maybe bread for lunch, and then dinner was the large meal with mostly vegetables, whatever they could, whatever was available, and fruit and bread for dinner. Meat was generally eaten only at festivals and special occasions. So Israelites were mostly vegetarian in their diet. Okay, and there's some further information on Israelite dining. Okay, now we turn to the historicity of the book of Judges. And we see kind of a timeline here. Very early period of the actual conquest and settlement, and then into the Iron Age 1 and 2a, the period of time covered by the events in the book of Judges. As we know, the Judges cycle, which is taught in all intro classes to the Old Testament, there was a cycle, a theological cycle, where Israel was, again, peace, everything was fine, Israel sins, and then God punishes Israel, and Israel repents and cries out, a judge or a charismatic leader is raised up by God, and Israel's delivered. And this cycle goes on and on. It gets worse and worse. In many ways, book of Judges is a very depressing book, because finally there's civil war. They're fighting each other rather than some sort of external threat. It's a map here showing general area of where all the major judges did their work, did their leadership. Okay, so let's look at the book of Judges as a historical source. Judges 1 is recognized as some sort of an annalistic military report that arranges events geographically and kind of telescopes long periods into brief spans of time. It's a summary account of military campaigns that shares parallels with contemporary Assyrian kings Tiglath-Pileser, the first of Assyria, kind of interesting connection there. And the similarity of language seems to fit well with that early Iron Age period. Okay, Judges 1, in contrast to other records, is that boast, rather than complains about failures, is an anti-conquest account. It's not political propaganda. It's actually quite shameful to the Israelite people, the way they acted, the way they behaved. So it's not any kind of boastful account. It's very, very sobering. And that's, again, unique in the ancient Near East. Most all accounts of historical accounts are always good, not judgmental. Okay. All right. So we have, again, some points about the early chapters in Judges. The children of Israel asked the Lord. Again, their neighbors would have consulted their gods before military engagements. The people of Canaan are mentioned, as we talked before. And Arad and Hormah in the book of Judges are mentioned as two sites in the Negev desert. And then, of course, also the land that remained unconquered. In the book of Joshua, it seems like there's success after success. But in Judges, it points out that a lot of the land was not conquered. The coastal plain and the valleys where the Canaanites were strong remained in Canaanite hands. Okay, and then there's land inheritance, Nahalot in Hebrew. This is land given by God, again, to a tribe, family, or clan. And we see these, again, reflected in later accounts, later biblical accounts. Nisa, a test that God gives Israel, is a test in loyalty and faithfulness to Him. So these are all theological points to the book of Judges. Now, we have an interesting account in Judges 1 through 20. There's a conquest of the southern part of Judah, what would later become the tribal territory of Judah. And this is a conquest and occupation of a Canaanite city by the name of Debir, or Kiriath Sefer, the village of the book or scroll. And this was, again, a hill country south of Hebron. And Caleb, as in Joshua and Caleb, one of the 12 spies, offered his daughter Aksa to the man who conquered Debir. And Othniel, the first judge, took the city and was given that land and the daughter. And Debir later became a Levitical city and went on. Now, where is Debir? Well, first of all, William Foxwell Albright excavated a site to the west of the hill country, west of Hebron, called Tel Beit Mirsim. We saw some pictures of it on an earlier slideshow. And he argued, and he argued all of his life very vehemently, that Tel Beit Mirsim was biblical Debir. And he seemed to believe that because the occupational history matched that of the biblical, the Debir of the biblical text. Now, scholars question Albright because Tel Beit Mirsim is too far to the west. It's in the Shvelah, eastern Shvelah, not in the hill country. And the biblical text in Judges specifically says in the hill country of Judah. And so the German scholar, Kurt Galling, found a site south of Hebron called Kerbet Rabud. And he surveyed that site and suggested that Kerbet Rabud was Debir, not Tel Beit Mirsim. We have to understand Albright had tremendous prestige, and to disagree with Albright was putting your life in your hand, so to speak, academically, because he was such a powerful giant figure. But giant figures like Albright, as good as they were, can be wrong, and Albright was wrong at this point. Now, in the late 60s, early 70s, Moshe Kochavi, Israeli scholar and archaeologist, excavated Kerbet Rabud, discovered two springs, mentioned in Judges, and identified an occupational history that matched Debir. And so Kerbet Rabud became, most scholars accepted it by then as Debir, not Tel Beit Mirsim. But Albright, before he died, wrote a rebuttal saying, "I still believe Tel Beit Mirsim is Kerbet, or rather Debir." But now it's widely accepted that Kochavi and before him Kurt Galling was correct. So authority figures in archaeology, be careful. Just like all of us, we can be mistaken and wrong, and even Albright made mistakes. Now the next judge, a very colorful person by the name of Ehud, Benjaminite, was raised by God to deliver the Israelites from the Moabites. And at this point in Israelite history, by the way, this is nice late Bronze, early Iron Age pottery here. Eglon was this very, very portly king of Moab, and he had set up shop in Jericho, not necessarily on the Tell, but adjacent to the site of Jericho near the spring, and had a palace there, and he was oppressing the Israelites. And so Ehud was ordained by God to deliver the Israelites. And so he was able to get past the guards and get a personal audience with Eglon. Because he was left-handed, the sword was on the right side. And he and Eglon were alone, and he stabbed Eglon with the sword. Eglon was so fat he couldn't get the sword back out. The fat folds of Eglon's skin prevented that. And Ehud made his escape and led the Israelites to victory over the Moabites. Again, Moab oppressed Israel for 18 years. This is the Balua Stela, found at Balua site in northern Karak Plateau around, I think it was in the 1930s that they found that. It's in the Jordanian National Museum now. Probably dates to around the time of Eglon, but we can't connect Eglon with this. Jericho is not specifically mentioned. It could have been Tamar because it's a city of the palms, but most people believe it was Jericho. We simply don't know. But anyway, There was a palace discovered at Jericho that seems to be Eglon's palace. And the description of the palace in the book of Judges seems to seems to clarify that it was a Beit Halani palace. This is, again, an outline of a typical Beit Halani palace from Tel Tainat in Turkey. And then the door lock on Eglon's door has been recreated here. Now, there is an excellent article on this episode by Baruch Halperin, and I think the journal Bible Review. And the Hebrew here seems to indicate that very, very crude, gross thought, but Ehud escaped the king's chamber. He didn't go out the door because the king's officials were out there and servants. He actually escaped through the privy, through the toilet, and climbed down through the toilet and got out of the palace that way. So a very earthy account of the death of Eglon and the escape of Ehud from that palace. Some pictures of from the time, or depicting the time of Deborah and Barak in Judges 4 and 5. Here's again Mount Tabor and the Jezreel Valley. Beautiful pictures there. Again, a lot of history. And we also saw a picture, a previous picture of the Spring of Harod, again depicting the selection of Gideon's army during the time of his being judge. This is the Hill of Moreh, and the Midianite camp would have been in the valley here, and so the Gideon's army would have surrounded that, broken their jars, and then attacked that night when they drove the Midianites out of that valley. So that just gives a kind of a beautiful couple of views of two biblical events from the period of the Judges. Now, we go to the main nemesis of Israel, and that was the Sea Peoples. And the Sea Peoples were a group of five distinctive peoples from the Aegean world, not necessarily from the same place, but from the Aegean world, that invaded the eastern Mediterranean seaboard during the early years of the 12th century. And this is an Egyptian depiction of a Philistine with a feathered headdress from Medinet Habu. And this is, again, an artist's depiction of what they would have looked like. Now, the mortuary temple of Ramses III, 20th dynasty king, I believe, it's 20th dynasty, is an incredibly, historical source for the Sea Peoples, because depicted on the walls of this mortuary temple is a sea and land battle between Ramses III and the Egyptian army and the Sea Peoples, who again invade Egypt by ship and by land. And the Egyptians were able to hold and push the Sea Peoples out of Egypt, but it must have been a tremendously bloody affair, because it really seemed to break the back of Egyptian power. And Egypt was never the same after this battle. Here's some artist depictions of what that would have looked like. Egyptian soldiers battling the Sea Peoples as they arrive on their boats. And that's all depicted in five distinctively clothed and distinctive peoples are depicted on the walls of the mortuary temple at Medinet Habu. And one of the most famous accounts of the book of Judges that deal with the Philistines is the account of Samson in chapters 13 through 16. And here we have, kind of for hopefully to make you smile, is a Hollywood depiction of Samson back in the 1940s, 1949. Hedy Lamarr and Victor Mature play the title roles of Samson and Delilah. You notice the language here is not English. It's actually a German edition. Samson und Delilah. That's appropriate because Hedy Lamarr was Austrian, I believe. But that, again, was an early attempt by Hollywood to make a blockbuster movie out of a biblical story. We talked about the Philistine temple at Tel Kasila before, or the Philistine settlement Tel Kasila, one of the early modern Israeli excavations. I want to point out something here, and this is a kind of typical of what archaeology can help us understand, and that is that this is, to date, really there's another Philistine temple that supposedly was found at Tel Asafi, parts of a Philistine temple. I don't think that's been well published yet. I may be wrong about that. But this is a fully excavated Philistine temple. Small, because this is not one of the Philistine capitals, a smaller Philistine settlement. But still, a Philistine temple. And the main feature of this temple is the fact that the roof is held up by two columns that are about an arm's length apart. And here they are here. And if you think about that and think about the life of Samson, you immediately recognize that Samson pushed down the temple at Gaza, killed all the Philistines and himself inside that temple. And you have the same type of structure here, only on a much smaller scale at this small Philistine town. We don't know the name of that. It's the modern name is Tel Kasila. But interesting to note that temple architecture tends to be the same in a certain specific civilization or a specific ethnic group. So the temples at Gaza and the other major Philistine epicenters would have had probably two main columns holding up the roof. So does that prove the story of Samson is true? No. But it certainly puts the story of Samson in an Iron One context during his actual life, which is very, very important. Again, a list of judges and the areas where they were active at the time of the book of Judges, the Iron One period. You can see the Israelite tribes on both sides of the Jordan, and then the judges. Names of the judges where their activities took place.
This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon in his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 14, The Israelite Settlement in the Book of Judges.